Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, June the 18th. Hope you had a good Father's Day yesterday, or that your dad did. Let me take a minute to thank John Munson and Jean Purcell for filling in for me while I was on vacation the past 2 weeks. I really appreciated it, and now they will learn that by doing that good deed for me, they did some good to themselves. We're going to talk about research that links doing good things for other people or the community or humanity in general and why that is good for all of us. It can help us lead longer, healthier, happier lives. Volunteer work, doing favors for people, performing random acts of kindness. Do you do those? Does it make you feel better? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or you can join the conversation via email at talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Our guest is Stephen Post. He is a professor of bioethics at the School of Medicine at the Case Western Reserve University. He is author of Why Good Things Happen to Good People, the exciting new research that proves the link between doing good and living a longer, healthier, happier life. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being with us. You are also the president of the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love. So this institute focuses on studying this stuff, the altruism, compassion, service, that sort of thing.
Exactly. It's not about the love of chocolate or, all sorts of different kinds of love, but it's simply about unselfish giving and all of its expressions and how it helps people who live that kind of a life.
Yeah, and there is scientific evidence that doing good for others is good for ourselves.
Very much. Strong evidence. It's come along very forcefully in the last 5 to 6 years. Why Good Things Happen to Good People, which I co-authored with Jill Nymark, a New York journalist, is all about that scientific research, and it's good news. It's good news because it says it's good to be good.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't have to be good by writing big checks to people.
No, you don't, although it doesn't hurt.
But you can. It doesn't mean you don't have to have deep pockets to benefit from
all.
This. Yeah.
Not at all. It's all about the little things. And in fact, what's really important, a lot of the research suggests, is just a purposeful small action a day that helps someone else, an action that is intended to be beneficial to a neighbor, to a family member, to a coworker. Just staying in that flow once a day in some small manner that may not seem consequential in the long run, but that's really the secret. And it doesn't mean you have to get on a jet plane and travel to the worst part of the world. Just turn right around to the person nearest to you and have a kind of confidence that you're the right person at the right time in the right place to be compassionate.
Let's talk about some of the scientific findings, the research that you talk about in your book that related to giving and our health. It says here that giving in high school predicts good physical and mental health in late adulthood, a time interval of over 50 years. Really?
Yes, that is really true. It's a wonderful study that was conducted by a premier psychologist, Paul Wink, who is at Wellesley College in Massachusetts, along with his wife, also a psychologist at the University of New Hampshire, Michelle Dillon. They went back to these studies that really began in the 1920s and early 30s at Berkeley, where individuals were followed their entire lives since childhood. They were interviewed regularly. They filled out questionnaires. Their health records were extensively assessed on a regular basis over the entire course of their lifetimes. And now, of course, these individuals are in their early 80s. And it turns out that the ones who early on in life identified a nobility of purpose, I want to do something for humanity with my talents, I want to make the world a better place, I want to use my creative gifts for good, those individuals over the course of their lifetimes were A, protected from depression, not entirely, but their levels were much lower than those who did not, in fact, have that kind of purpose early in life. They were protected from various physical-induced illnesses. And the odds are, if you look at the study, that they live slightly longer lives. And I think that makes a lot of sense because we already knew from the 1990s that negative emotions like anger and hostility can shorten lives.
Yeah. So if we weren't, though, givers in high school, are we out of luck?
No, not at all, because what you do when you're young doesn't necessarily determine what you do when you're older. And I'm sure there are many people in that study who changed their ways in midlife due to some kind of a crisis. But the idea is that whenever in life you begin to just start to think about others deeply and sincerely, when you stop relating to other people insofar as they can only contribute to your narrow agendas, and you discover, you stumble on the happiness of being generous, at that point, your life changes. So even with older adults, we have three studies from Stanford, University of Michigan, and Berkeley, three major studies on mortality rates in older adults, 60 years of age and older, and the ones who are involved in giving behaviors, volunteerism, even just 100 hours a year, had significantly lower mortality rates than those who were not that, engaged in that way.
But do we know if there is the direct correlation? Maybe it's that people who are more likely to volunteer for one or more organizations are people who, you know, lead healthier lives overall anyway.
Well, that's right. And so this gets into that really important question, Joy, of cause and effect. You can ask, well, do we have the cart before the horse here? Hey, I think there's no question that people who are healthier physically and mentally tend to volunteer more. That's very clear. But the evidence is also very clear that those who do, in fact, volunteer and who live helpful lives and who express generous and compassionate emotions, they also get a benefit in the other direction. So it works both ways. All the researchers have been careful to tease apart as well as they can cause and effect, taking into account baseline health at the start of these studies. So when you get to the final analysis, it's as strong a statement as the scientists can make that indeed it's good to be good. That when we help others, we help ourselves. We've had brain scientists who have looked at the ways in which even a decision to donate to charity lights up the part of the brain that doles out feel-good chemicals like serotonin and dopamine. One study was done at the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, by researcher Jorge Mole. And I think essentially it points out that we're pretty hardwired to take joy and to be psychologically benefited by a generous lifestyle.
And I was happy to read that even thinking about doing charitable things is helpful to us, because I'm someone who thinks, oh, I want to volunteer for this, that, and the other thing, but I don't have time. But just thinking about it is doing me good.
Yeah, well, let me give you two really great studies on that. There was a famous, famous social psychologist named David McClelland at Harvard University. He died in 1999, unfortunately, but he took Harvard students and he had them watch, he had two groups. He had one group watch an emotionally neutral movie, and another group watched a really poignant movie of Mother Teresa helping poor people in the ghettos of Calcutta. And so it turns out that the ones who watched Mother Teresa had lower stress hormones and elevated immunoglobulin A, which is a chemical in the body that improves your resistance. So that was really exciting. And then he took that second group, the one that was watching the Mother Teresa movie, okay, and he split them into two, and he asked one group to actually focus on or meditate on giving helping behavior. And that group retained this elevated immunological response vis-a-vis the other. And then the study also on thinking about doing good, which I alluded to earlier, is the one that came out just in 2006, published in the premier journal, The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. You take 20 people, put them in a laboratory environment, Joy, and you put a magnetic resonance device over their heads that picks up their brain activity. Put a list of charities in their hands. Next to each line item charity, okay, mm-hmm. you put a box. And you say, okay, when you run into a charity that you'd like to give something to, check the box. So when people check the box, guess what happens? The it's called the mesolimbic pathway of their brain lights up. It's the part of the brain that's associated with pleasure. It lights up when people have a good meal. It doles out feel-good chemicals. And so that's really exciting because it explains what we sort of knew since the 1980s. It was well described in Psychology Today, the helper's high, that people who get out and help people report a kind of buoyancy, a kind of warmth, a kind of glow, and even report feeling better physically. So suddenly you get a neurological picture of why it is, you know, that, hey, the story of Scrooge is a pretty good one, because while he was unhappy and unforgiving and selfish, he was, there was no life in him at all. But then as he becomes more generous, well, by the end of the story, Dickens has him jumping up and down the streets of some unidentified city in old London, and there was never a happier man. He's helping everybody in sight. So he's got the helper's high, and there's little question, I think, that his serotonin levels mm-hmm. are up there.
We're talking with Stephen Post, a professor of bioethics at the School of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University. He is co-author of the book, Why Good Things Happen to Good People, the exciting new research that proves the link between doing good and living a longer, healthier, happier life. 1-800-642-1234, our toll-free number for you to join in the conversation. In Madison, 263-1890-263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And I wonder if you do volunteer work or give to charity or try to do random acts of kindness or good deeds for your neighbors or your community or humanity in general, and why you do that. Does it make you feel better? Well, it certainly is good for you, according to the research, according to our guest. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Gene Faraca is with you this afternoon between 3 and 4 here on Earth with Gene Faraca. Gene will be talking with Al Gore about his new book, The Assault on Reason, plus commentary from John Nichols. That's coming up this afternoon after 3 o'clock. We're talking about why good things happen to good people. We're talking about the link between doing good things for others and how that is good for us. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Giving is good medicine, according to the research. That's what our guest outlines in his new book, Why Good Things Happen to Good People. Stephen Post is a professor of bioethics at Case Western Reserve University, and he is also the president of the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love, which focuses on the scientific study of altruism, compassion, and service. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Open lines for you to talk about giving and why you give or why you volunteer and how that makes you feel and why you do it. And find out how this is good for you. You know, Professor Post, there's an old saying that only the good die young. That's not true.
No, Billy Joel had a hit song of that title. You probably remember. I'm originally from Long Island and grew up just a few miles from Billy Joel's house, actually, and ran into him as a young guy. But yeah, it's true. Of course, sometimes people who are wonderful get into circumstances unavoidably that cut their lives short. But if you look at the literature with any kind of care in general, Billy Joel had it wrong. people who live good lives, who are compassionate, who are concerned about others, who are unselfish, live happier, healthier, and again, odds are longer lives. Now, it's an important message because, there are too many people who think that bad things happen to good people. It's just not the case, as a generalization, that that's true. When you live warmly and caringly, when you're concerned about others, there are so many aspects of your life that benefit not just your health, but even your external circumstances.
Yeah. You have in your book 10 ways to give in four domains of life. Like what?
Well, those are 10 ways of giving, and they're ways of giving that I've been interested in since even the 1980s when I wrote a dissertation around some of these ideas at the University of Chicago. I know there are probably some Chicagoans listening to this. But one way of giving is gratitude and celebration. When we take the time to express gratitude to others, when we celebrate the benchmarks in their lives, we're affirming them, we're telling them that their accomplishments are meaningful to us. We're saying that their lives count for something. That's important. And we have gratitude research pointing out that individuals who just take a half an hour a week to keep a gratitude journal and reflect on the five things in life that they're most grateful for, those individuals, in fact, report greater happiness than those who do not, in fact, have a sense of gratitude, an attitude of gratitude, if you will. So there it is. You know, it's good to be grateful and to celebrate other people's lives. They sure appreciate it. But it's also good for the person who's being grateful, and that's the kind of the paradox of it. You know, it's good to be good, and when we care for others, it's great for them, but it's great for us too.
Yeah. So sending that thank you note I sent last week added some years to my life.
Well, not necessarily years to your life. In the gratitude research, we can't quite say that, but we do know that it will increase your happiness and it will have psychological benefits. Sometimes today, people have forgotten how to write gratitude notes. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yeah, it's not very often, yeah.
It's not very often, and I try to be really careful about it myself. I write thank you notes to a lot of people. I don't make a full-time job out of it, although sometimes I feel that I could. But, you know, in all of the great spiritual and philosophical traditions, it's not just gratitude of an interpersonal sort. I'm grateful to this person who helped me along in life and so forth. But, you know, it's also a sense of gratitude for the earth, for the universe, for the world that we live in.
So I helped put on a graduation party for my nephew. That was something that it did make me feel good. And the research says that that's going to contribute to me living a longer, healthier, happier life.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, being grateful is a good thing for those who are grateful. And when you look at people's lives at the graduation parties, you know, we have those here at this university. Of course, everyone in the country celebrates these things at the right time of the year. You know, the amount of joy and fulfillment and the buoyancy in the faces of parents and relatives is just incredible. And you got to realize, Joy, that, you know, all of that positive emotion is setting aside a lot of negative emotion, potentially, all the hostility, the resentment, the anger, all the negative emotions that build stress, contribute to ill health over the course of a lifetime. Those things are just pushed aside by this kind of spirited, effervescent celebration. And that's a good thing. It's positive emotionally, and we know very clearly that positive emotions are good for health.
Yeah. Besides a celebration and gratitude, how can we give?
Well, we have a nice chapter on forgiveness, and the forgiveness research is absolutely overwhelming, you know, to the extent that every once in a while you'll see a whole volume of Newsweek or Time magazine dedicated to it. The forgiveness research distinguishes forgiveness from reconciliation. There's a lot of relationships in life that are harmful and abusive, and it would be bad to try to reconcile in those situations without the most sincere and meaningful apology and then perhaps a whole lot of therapy. But the bottom line is that letting go of hatreds and resentments internally for yourself is incredibly important. People who are forgiving when compared with those who are not have a considerably lower rate, for example, of respiratory infection. That's very understandable because when you're not forgiving, when you keep turning things over in your mind day in and day out instead of letting them go, the studies show that, again, your stress hormones are up, your immune system is down, so you're reliving the past. And every time you do that, it's like going through a fresh experience of anger and hatred. And when that happens in an extended or protracted way, instead of just in a short burst, but when it just hangs around over the course of your weeks and months and years, it really does hurt you.
We're talking with Stephen Post. He is author of Why Good Things Happen to Good People, talking about research that links doing good and living a longer, healthier, happier life. Doing good deeds for others, good for ourselves. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Do you have any questions about how giving is good for all of us? Or do you have any examples, perhaps, of how your giving or your volunteering or your good deeds really were good for you as well? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or talk@wpr.org. A little bit surprised that we haven't had a whole lot of response yet, asking questions or giving examples. But there we go. Now our lines are lighting up. Professor Post, tell me about your some sort of love and longevity scale. What is that?
Well, yes. Thanks for mentioning that, Joy. So at the end of every chapter, there are 10 major chapters, each on a way of giving, a chapter on listening, a chapter on forgiveness, a chapter on celebration, a chapter on helping and generativity and so forth. At the end of every chapter, there's a 20-item scale, which asks you questions about that particular strength area in giving. You can take the scale, it probably takes 5 minutes to do it, and then see where you fit compared to others in terms of that particular strength. And if you're strong in that area, we recommend building on it, maintaining it, enhancing it. If it's an area where you're relatively weak, then you can do things to improve in that area as well. But it gives you a kind of a sense of where you're at with these expressions of giving, and it also allows you to have a kind of purposefulness or an attentiveness on giving, which in itself is a good thing.
Yeah. And it's true, research says that actually giving to people does you more good than if you receive the help. Is that right?
Well, that's interesting. In the studies on older adults and mortality, and especially I'm thinking of a study by a premier researcher named Stephanie Brown at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Yeah, she teased this apart with older adults and found out that the reduction in mortality rates for those who were socially connected rather than isolated was considerable. That's uncontroversial. We've known that for about 15 years. There's about a 20% reduction in mortality rates for the connected vis-a-vis the isolated. But then she said that the overwhelming benefit comes not from receiving support, but from giving support, probably 70 to 80%. Now, that's really interesting. You may be familiar with, say, Alcoholics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a step in the 12-step program, Joy. It's called the 12th step. And it asks that people who are recovering find someone else who has the problem of alcoholism and helps them, listens to them, sponsors them, brings them to meetings, becomes a friend, and so forth. Well, one of our studies by Maria Pagano, who's premier and has been at Brown University for many years, that study showed that the people who fulfilled the 12th step, who helped someone else with the problem, had a 40% successful recovery rate. And for those who didn't help other people with alcoholism, they only had a 22% recovery rate. And so the point is that, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, they say, well, I help others because it helps myself. I'm not appealing to selfishness here. You know, I'm not saying that we should help others in selfish ways. I'm just saying that part of the human essence, Joy, is to be generous. And when we tap into that, when we disinhibit it, when we let it blossom and flower, we discover a part of ourselves that's really important, that gives us a lot of joy, that makes us psychologically whole, that allows us to feel happier, and again, you know, keeps us away from those negative emotions that are well established for their compromising our longevity and our well-being.
Let's go to the phones. Wendy in Oconomowoc, good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about my father because, especially with Father's Day, it helped remind me of it. But he was a retired school teacher, and he taught life science, and he was very much interested in the environment. And his main thing that he did in his retirement was he would give to these charitable organizations. And as he grew older and more informed and more infirmed and less able to get out and do things, he'd write letters, and he would do things that he could do. And he's still in 80, he's 89 now, and he's in a nursing home, but he's still doing relatively okay for his age. And he still thinks about these things, and I tell him yes, because I'm his POA now, and we sit down and we talk about what organizations, like he contributed to Greenpeace and the Federation for Wildlife and a lot of these things, and I talk to him about all these things, and he really lights up. He still lights up about it.
Yeah. Professor Post?
Well, you know, it gives your dad, bless him, a sense of meaning and purpose. He retired from teaching the life sciences in school, and he went on and he found a purpose that even went beyond just the school, but really embraced the whole planet and ecological well-being and all of these different things. So he's got purpose, and that's important. And he's also doing things that seem kind of trivial, I guess, you know, writing a letter or maybe sending out a $30 or $40 check. But the bottom line is that actually those things are important. And the science says that just thinking about helping organizations can have some benefits. So there he is in a nursing home, and he's still alive and vibrant and generative and giving and thinking about the future of humanity and the future of the planet Earth. You know, that's a good thing for him. And it's not just, by the way, one of the points that this brings up, it's not just that people who volunteer get a little bit of physical exercise like you would if you were working out at a gymnasium. These studies on the benefits of volunteerism carry forward in many volunteer situations that involve absolutely no physical activity whatsoever. So you can't reduce this to a good workout. Your dad is in a nursing home. He's doing these wonderful things. He's talking with you about them. It gives him meaning and purpose in life. That's a beautiful thing, and in the process, you know, his brain is even doling out chemicals that make him feel good about life. So that's a nice thing.
Yeah, thank you, Wendy, and happy Father's Day to your dad, Don in Eau Claire. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Listening to the conversation, very interesting. As an aside, I've got to tell your speaker that I lived in Little Neck, Long Island, for a while, so we must think along the same lines. Anyway, you know, I've never had enough money to send money to everything, but I like people. And so I find myself constantly, you know, like if somebody needs directions, instead of just telling them, I'll say, follow me. And I'm just a people person, and that's sort of how I do my thing, and it seems to work out well for me.
So. Professor Post?
Well, that's a beautiful statement from a fellow Long Islander, although, you know, I've lived in Chicago and Ann Arbor and Cleveland for 19 years, so I identify with Route 80, actually. but for sure, you know, we're really talking about a way of doing, but a way of being. It's just a constant state of being concerned and interested in the well-being of other people, doing small things that convey the message that, you know, their happiness and their security and even them getting to the right place they're looking for through providing directions, that matters to us. And it's those little events in life that I find to be so important. You know, it's not so difficult to be courteous and generous and compassionate in a university workplace with students or with colleagues. When I go to church on Sunday, I go to the Episcopal Church in Cleveland Heights. You know, it's kind of expected that you'll be kind and generous with people. At home, you know, you want to have this kind of warmth and tender, loving care in the neighborhood with the softball teams or the baseball teams or the soccer teams. You know, you see all these parents and kids, and you see them repeatedly. You know, so in those environments, you know, it's in some ways easier to be kind and compassionate and attentive and helpful than it is in those relationships where you'll never see somebody again. So if someone asks you for directions and you take the time to say, hey, follow me, I'll get you down this block and show you where that left fork is in the road, you know, that's a really beautiful thing. And actually, it means a lot because it suggests that you're in kind of a flow of giving. And it's so easy when you just encounter a person a single time, and then you'll never see him again, right? Mm-hmm. To use the word that's now in Webster's 10th, to diss them, to, you know, be a little bit rough or harsh, or to say something that you don't need to say. That can happen with the cashier at a Walmart. It can happen at any place in life. It can happen when you're driving and the person in front of you just didn't quite rush through that yellow light, and you want to get home, and you mm-hmm. fall full-breasted on the horn and create a moment of road rage. It's those kinds of moments, like, you know, if we're talking about here, where you really want to pay attention to staying in the flow of kindness.
Thanks, Don, for the call, and I hope I find you next time I'm lost in Eau Claire. We're talking with Stephen Post. He is a professor of bioethics at the School of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University. He is co-author of the new book, Why Good Things Happen to Good People, the exciting new research that proves the link between doing good and living a longer, healthier, happier life. Talking about the science of goodness, talking about how doing good deeds is good for ourselves, and welcoming your thoughts and questions about this. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is coming up after 9 o'clock. And Kathleen will be joined by journalist Carl Bernstein to talk about his new biography of Hillary Clinton called A Woman in Charge. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking about the link between generosity and being good and giving and how that is related to us living a longer, happier, healthier life. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Jackie in Drummond is with us now. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. Well, I turned in a little late, but I didn't know if this was appropriate, but then you started to talk about forgiveness, and yesterday in church our sermon was about forgiveness. And as we all know, in our mandate, in our elections, you know, we are against the war, and we're so sad about what happened. And I know this president would never have the courage to say, I'm sorry, we made a mistake. Will the world forgive us and help us? But to me, that seems the only thing that's left, and you just don't hear that. And here is this man, Christian man, quote-unquote, the president, who will not admit to anything. And I was just wondering, ethically, would that help, you know, our stature in the world?
Well, I don't know if our guests can talk about how that, you know, but I want to talk a little bit more about, I don't know, the forgiveness angle on that.
Yeah. Well, Jackie, you know, that's a really meaningful comment, and we thank you for it. You know, in the world today, we need to get into the practice of group apology and group forgiveness. It's not just about forgiveness between individuals. Increasingly, you know, you'll read reports about a president making an apology, for example, for slavery. One of our researchers, Sam Oliner, who himself was a survivor of the Holocaust, he'd been rescued by a Christian family. He spent his whole life as a social scientist going back and interviewing the rescuers and finding out what it is that made some people rescue these Jewish children like Sam and other people not do so. And he's got a new book coming out on intergroup apology. I look at the world today, Jackie, I see all the intergroup hatreds. I see the great Abrahamic faiths at odds. I see civilizational conflict. And there are moments when I think that, you know, the love of neighbor that we all know is the only hope for the future, it's kind of a thin veneer over a seething, boiling cauldron. And apology is really important if we're going to ever get out of this. I don't know how, what the right strategy is, and I'm not going to speak too politically, but I will say that I think we need to really understand the importance of sincere, meaningful apology between ethnic mm-hmm. groups, classes, religious groups, et cetera, because there's just so much sectarian strife. And it seems to have gotten to a point where, hey, you know, Mr. Rogers, you may remember him. He was a friend of mine. He was from Pittsburgh. He died a few years ago. Mm-hmm. A few weeks after 9/11, Joy, he said to a New York Times reporter who'd asked him what parents should tell their children. You know, he said, tell the children to keep their eyes on the helpers. And I think that's the thing we need to do. Despite all the strife and conflict, we need to realize that people maintain their dignity, their humanity, their love of neighbor, even in these kinds of situations. And we need to look at them and understand them and emulate them.
Thank you, Jackie, for the call. Eugene in Viola is with us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Joy. I'm like one of your previous callers, a people person. I do the little things in a process of a day's time, process of a lifetime. And I started this probably about 45 years ago. I left industry. I think I was making $6,500. 2 years later, I signed my first teaching contract for $3,500. I've never looked back, and I've never regretted that in the least bit. I just had a lot of fun over a lifetime. And one of the little things I do is I hold doors. Just hold the door for somebody. Just take the time. Maybe a few feet away, 10 or 15 feet. But just stand and just hold that door for them. And that does pay off.
Yeah.
I always look for the little things that can be done at a moment's notice.
Yeah. May I respond? What is your name again? I missed that, Joy.
His name was Eugene.
Mm-hmm. Eugene. Hi, Eugene. Okay. Hi, Eugene. So listen, it's the little things that are done with love that make the difference. And I'm telling you, you know, 99.9% of the energy of kindness and generosity in our world has nothing to do with, you know, doing big things. It's all about small things. It's about the details of our lives done with a smile, with an attitude of kindness. And you know what? It's kind of like a dandelion, you know, when you blow a dandelion and all the little bits of dandelion blow off into the universe. I think when you do something really small and sometimes unexpected for people, you know, it just makes their day, and they carry that forward with them wherever they go. And so you're kind of spreading this. And you know, I will say, my grandfather was married to a woman named Emily who wrote a lot of cookbooks. He eventually divorced her, a lot of etiquette books too. And I think the recovery of etiquette, actually in the book, there, Why Good Things Happen to Good People, there's a chapter on respect as an expression of kindness and love. And there's a long piece there on etiquette and civility and tolerance. But these things like opening the door for someone, just doing small things with an attitude of respect and kindness. I think we need so much more of that in our world, because a lot of the culture has gotten pretty rude and rough-edged, and you just don't know quite what to do about it.
Yeah. Thanks, Eugene, and thanks for also one of the nice things Eugene does is he drives bushel baskets full of apples to us every fall at Wisconsin Public Radio as a contribution to Wisconsin Public Radio staff and volunteers. Isn't that nice?
Wow.
Yeah, and I didn't know that you were, did you say you're Emily Post's nephew? Is that what?
No, well, she was, my grandfather married twice. His first wife was Emily.
Okay.
And then he divorced her because he fell in love with the chorus girl on Broadway. So my actual grandmother is not Emily, but she was my, I don't know what you'd call her.
Like almost.
Almost, yeah, yeah, like okay. Almost. But the myth in our family was pretty significant. So we talked a lot about simple things. And she didn't believe in elitism at all. She felt that every life, at every level, would benefit from simple courtesy and kindness in the small details. And mm-hmm. and that's even echoed in a statement by someone like Mother Teresa, who says there are no great acts of love, only small things done with great love.
Yeah. Chris in Maguanago is next. Hi, Chris.
Oh, thank you for letting me talk to your guest, Mr. Post. What a great segue from Mother Teresa. That was how I was going to start my story. Anyway, I'm someone who has adopted a preemie about 12 years back. I had 5 biological children of my own. Nothing that I did in raising them prepared me for what I would have to do raising my preemie. I originally took him believing that he would die, and we were in hospice care for a while, but of course he hasn't died. I wanted to call attention, and I hope I do so by my life, of the issues of kids born prematurely. The percentage is about 13%, and about 40% of those will never live independently, and my son is one of those kids. When my other older kids hear about my son and me living our lives here in Maguanago, they do say, oh, she's like Mother Teresa, meaning I'm like Mother Teresa, and I am embarrassed by that. Here's the real story, and I think it may be so with other people who embrace altruism. I would like to be like Mother Teresa. I would like to be really altruistic, and so I do things in my life to train myself up that way. People say that I'm patient with my son. I'm really not patient, but patience is my focus, and so I keep trying to be patient. And you may see one or the other little act of patience, but you may also see a lot of impatience. I confess to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say that has been a great lesson in my life, that you aren't necessarily altruistic, but if you focus on it, then you'll continually do things and focus on things and redirect your attention to things that will bring you to that goal, and you give yourself a lifetime to get to that goal. And I feel like I have to be very humble about it, because as soon as I feel like, oh, yeah, maybe I am Mother Teresa, then what happens is I have a huge fit of impatience and get all screwed up and embarrass myself and, have to slap myself upside the head and say, oh, come on, get back on track. But the other piece of this message, and I want to say it again, is that there are about 13% of all kids being born prematurely. That is my profession, by the way. I'm an NICU nurse who took a patient home 12 years ago. 13% of kids are being born prematurely these days, and they have lots and lots of long-term problems and issues. And like I say, 40% won't live independently. My son is one of those.
Yeah. Well, bless you, Chris. And Professor Post, a reaction?
Well, Chris, I find what you've done, you have 5 biological children, yes?
Yes.
And then what is your adopted son's name?
His name is Victor.
Victor, I find that to be really powerful. In fact, I was reading a book called Acres of Hope about a woman named Patty Anglin, who has a ranch up there in Wisconsin where she has devoted her life to the care of adopted children with special needs. I mean, I find what you're doing to be incredibly powerful. When I hear these kinds of stories, I'm really moved. I think that you're right. when you spend time around people who are disabled in various ways, particularly developmentally, cognitively disabled.
Yes.
You know, you learn how to be a very good listener, don't you? You learn how to pick up on their emotions in ways that are really profound and really deep. You know, a couple of months ago, I actually held a conference in Trosly, France, with Jean Vanier, who founded L'Arche, the ARC, this international faith-based movement for children with these kinds of difficulties. And, you know, he was the most sensitive man. He was so intuitive. He was such a good listener. He was, to be around him was just absolutely uplifting. And I think it was because, you know, he didn't talk so much, but he had such an ability to kind of empathize with people. And that's what you know, when you interact with Chris, Victor, Chris, you know, what you're doing is of course, Victor depends on you tremendously, but you are also growing. And I couldn't agree with you more. You know, you never get to a point of, you know, being, you know, a saint, or you never get to a point where you say, aha, this is love, this is care. It's not so much a place as a direction. And when you're in a situation with Victor, you know, you're in a direction in life that's also an example for a whole lot of other people. So I completely commend what you're doing. I've spent the whole last 20 years of my career actually working with the Alzheimer's Association. I've been up to Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and just about every little town in Wisconsin working with the Alzheimer's Association over the years. And I've been on the board of L'Arche USA. So I really feel that a lot of times, you know, these people come into our lives, people with cognitive disabilities, and we think, oh, throw them in the wastebasket. They don't count. You know, they can't work for themselves. They can't earn money. They may not even be able to speak coherently. But I believe they actually reveal to us what's most fundamental about being human, which is the need to give and receive love. And so I commend you, and I appreciate you, and you're doing good in the world, Chris, and thank you for it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chris. Well, only a minute or so to go, Professor Post. There's a caller online who wonders if maybe you can give too much. Maybe if you give too much of yourself, you're not going to have that longer, healthier, happier life because you're going to be drained.
That's an excellent point. Mm. And the mortality studies for that caller on older adults point out that, yeah, there are benefits in giving, in being pro-social, in reaching out to others. But on the other hand, if you get overwhelmed by it, then there are negative impacts. So, for example, Alzheimer's caregivers who live these 36-hour days and don't get enough support in their community, they can have higher depression rates than the general population. So the big caveat on all of this is, hey, don't overdo it. It doesn't take a lot. We're just talking about coloring your life, you know, with generosity, but not failing to take care of yourself or putting yourself in a situation where you're so exhausted that you can't prosper.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Joy, it's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
Stephen Post, co-author of Why Good Things Happen to Good People. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.